All right, so what we're going to start to do now is develop some searches, which are pretty much the same as the searches we've been looking at, except they're going to try and be a little bit smarter about the way in which they are dealing with information that's available. Because again, this is a sort of a meta technique, which is to exploit as much information as you can that you can derive from the problem. And the breadth first, depth first, and generic searches are not exploiting any information. Well, that's not true. They're exploiting the minimal amount of information in the sense that they are looking at the structure of the state space graph. Right? But there's a lot more information there, and what we want to do is exploit that and try and produce a better search, better in terms of its performance and in terms of the kinds of goals that it can find. And the first observation to motivate ourselves is that one of the assumptions that both breadth first and depth first make is that if they are at a node, if they're at a node that is not a goal state, right, so the search isn't over, then they have to pick children. They go on to the children. And essentially what they say is both of them assume that all children are the same. Right? Because depth-first search says, well, I'll explore this child next, but it really has no choice. It's really not making an intelligent choice. It's just more or less randomly picking. And, of course, breadth-first search says, well, put all the children in the queue. Put all the children in the queue and don't make any distinctions among them. Right? But that's not a real smart thing to do because, at the very least, what's the minimum distinction you want to draw between children? What is the most obvious piece of information you'd like to know about the children? And use that as a basis for having a more intelligent choice among the children. It's that some of these children are on paths to the goal state and others of them are not. So some children lead to goals. So what we'd like to do is somehow discriminate towards the children that are on the goal path and ignore the children that aren't because they can't possibly lead us to anything that we're interested in. But, so that's what we'd like to do, but there's a problem with that. And what's that problem? What's the problem with this observation? It's not clear how that relates. There's a more fundamental problem, that's true, but our assumption is we can make that determination. Right? But there's a more fundamental problem with this observation, which is we don't know what the goal state is. That's the point of the search, right? So we don't really know which children, in fact, are leading to the goal state. Well, this observation, although it's nice, doesn't seem to really get us very far. But actually, it turns out to be the basis for a lot of the techniques that we're going to be talking about tonight. Because even though we can't say for sure which one of these children lead us to goal states, we can make guesses as to which children might lead us to a goal state. Right? So even though we don't know, we can make intelligent guesses. Those intelligent guesses are known as heuristics. And let me not say intelligent, although that's one way to think about it. Let me just say instead informed guesses about. Even though we can't know, we can make guesses. And there's a number of words here that are important. The informed part is the part where we're extracting information from the goal state or from the state space itself. Right? So this is the part where we're exploiting information. Guesses means that we could be wrong. So unlike this observation, which assumes that we know for a fact which children lead to a goal state, when we use heuristics, we're guessing. So that means that we could be wrong. And one of the things we like to do is sort of manipulate the probabilities so that our guesses are pretty good. In other words, we're not wrong very often. And you do that, of course, by extracting better information and applying it more usefully, as we'll see. And then, of course, good depends upon what you're interested in. An obvious definition of good is the one we've been using up to this point, which is essentially is on the path to the goal. All right. But if you have a more advanced kind of a search where you're looking for some sort of extremal path, either a minimum path or a maximum path, then you're going to have a more restricted criteria, because not only should the children be on goal paths, but they should also be on the smallest goal path if you're looking for minimums, or the largest if you're looking for maximums. Okay, so that's the general point of view that we're going to be adapting for the searches that we're going to be talking about to finish this lecture. Let us think about a particular kind of search, and I believe that search is, let me just check and make sure. Let's assume that we're interested in extreme value searching. Actually, let me not say value, let me say cost or weight. So we're interested in extreme cost, and extreme, of course, here means min and max. You may have some other definitions for example, you might want to look for the average path. I'm not sure why you might want to do that, but maybe you want a margin of safety on both sides or something like that. But you're just looking for a particular value among all the possible paths that lead you to a goal state. And, of course, we've talked about cost in the lecture on graph searching. This is essentially just a mapping of either edges or states. Doesn't make much difference to this discussion. To real values, and you essentially sum the values along the path to give you the cost of the path. So we're looking for, again, min or max cost paths to the goal state. All right? Now, what kind of heuristic or guess can we make when we look in this circumstance? This is not a goal state, so let's put a G through here, and I have red, so let's do that. All right, so it's a non-goal state, which means we have to go on, we have to pick among the children, and the question becomes, which child should we pick? Again, is there any information we can exploit to pick a good child? And just to make it concrete, let's assume that we're interested in the minimum cost path to the goal state. So which of those children do you think would be wise to pick next?
Would be minimal.
Exactly. The child that has the minimum cost. So you would like to pick the min cost child. So that's of course, a pretty simple heuristic. Now, I don't know. Does that seem like something that could go wrong? It seems like if you always pick the min-cost child, you're going to have the min-cost path. Does everyone agree with that? So, in fact, this is better than a heuristic. It actually guarantees. So, like, a heuristic is a guess. You could be wrong, but your claim is that if we use this technique of picking the min-cost child, then we're always going to get the cheapest path. Is that correct? Does everyone agree with that?
Yes.
Everyone does?
May or may not.
So can you give me an example of where it wouldn't, where picking the min-cost child would not result in the cheapest path to the min-cost path to the goal? Can you give me an example that demonstrates that using this technique of picking the min-cost child leads to a path that is not minimum? So here's the start state. Here's the goal state, and I'm going to look at the weight on the edges because I don't want to draw too much. So here is the cost of this edge is 1, and the cost of this edge is 10. So using this approach, this is not a goal state. What's going to happen? You're going to pick the min-cost child and go here. All right, now what am I going to do? What kind of weights am I going to put on here? Exactly. So I can do this. If I pick the min-cost child, I'm going to incur a cost of 1 plus 100 for 101 to get to the goal state this way, whereas if I had picked this child, I would have gone from 10 and 1 to 11. So clearly, picking the min-cost child is a heuristic. It is a guess. It is not guaranteed to produce the good results that we want. But, of course, if these were flipped, then we would have won, right? Because we would have picked this, then that, and we're done. Okay, that's an interesting observation. Does anybody have any comments on that? You're right, but you're missing a very important point. What does the search know? Does the search know this? No, it doesn't. Right? The search knows what? The frontier. Right? That's the other point about the frontier. The frontier is another way to think about the frontier is it represents the limit of knowledge that the search has about the graph. Okay? And that's sort of related to the fact that behind the frontier are the explored nodes and in front of the frontier are the unexplored nodes. Right? So at this point, I mean, we can draw the frontier in here, right? At the start, this is the frontier. Okay? And then, this is all the graph, this is all the search knows. Everything on the upper side of the frontier is everything the search knows. And then it expands, right, the children, so now the frontier looks like this. Okay? And now the search can say, oh, let's take the min-cost child here, and that's the commit. At that point, it's committed. You're absolutely right. If the search had the entire graph, then it might be able to figure out that this path is expensive and this path is cheap. But the interesting question is, how would it do that? Which we're not going to look at because that would take us too far afield. Okay? But that's an important point. Again, so another way to think about the frontier is it represents the limit of what the search knows about the graph. And you just keep pushing the frontier until it bangs into a goal node and you're done. Well, potentially done anyway. So we have a heuristic here and not certain knowledge. Now the question is, how do we use this? How do we exploit this in, for example, depth-first or breadth-first search? Or, for that matter, generic search? So how do we exploit this knowledge about picking min cost? How would you modify either any of those searches, GSA, DFS, or BFS, to take into account the min cost? Let's take BFS first. Let me not do it that way. Let me change this. All right. What does the search look like when we exploit this min cost? What kind of search do we have? Well, the question is, how do we exploit it? What does the search look like? Well, again, what do we want to do at... Just remember how our search works. We start with a frontier, which contains S to start. And then while the frontier is not empty, we pick something from the frontier. We pick a path from the frontier. Right, and it's at this point that we want to pick what? The cheapest path, the min cost path. So what kind of frontier are we going to have that allows us to do that? Again, this is your data structure knowledge kicking in at this point. Right, but how do I get that out of the frontier, right? If I use a queue, it's first in, first out. If I use a stack, it's last in, first out. If I use a set, it's arbitrary. So I need something else. It's a priority queue. I can use a priority queue or a min heap or a max heap. So I replace the other representations of a frontier with a priority queue. And the priority would be the cost of the path up to the point at which it enters the priority queue. Right? And if I'm interested in this case, our example is min cost, so this would be a min priority queue or a min heap. Either one's fine. Otherwise, it remains the same. So again, you know, it's like it's a plug-in kind of algorithm where you just replace the representation of the frontier with your favorite data structure. All right, so let's go on and take a look at some more heuristics. Another thing to note is that breadth-first search and depth-first search are, in a sense, blind. Right? They just, if they're at a particular node, they only see forward to the children. Okay, and then they just either stuff the children in a stack or stuff it in a queue. Alright? Extreme cost searching or min cost or max cost searching looks backwards. Right? If it's at a particular node and it's looking at children, what it looks at is the entire path from the start node to the child, the start state to the child. That's represented by the cost. Okay, so breadth first search and depth first search are essentially blind, or they don't look at all. Or if you prefer, they look locally, very locally, only at the children. The extreme cost search, extreme CS, extreme cost search is backwards looking, which is essentially the cost itself. What's the only direction left? Sorry, forwards, exactly. It would be interesting to think about a search that looks forward. Okay, but what does it mean to look forward? Well, first of all, let's just think. Would we like to have a search that looks forward? Actually, this goes back to your observation you made like 5 minutes ago. Would it be an advantage to us to have a search that looks forward? Maybe it's a really dumb idea and we should go on to the next topic. But is it? Or is it something that we should just ignore? Right. So your observation about, what if the search could see everything, then it could choose the right point, right? Is actually essentially what happens if the search looks forward? So it seems like we do, because I mean the obvious answer is, well, yes, you want to look forward because that's where the goal is, right? The goal is out there someplace. So if the search can look forward and find the goal, then yeah, that's what we want to do. Okay, but now we're back to this point. So the answer here is yes, we want this. This is something we want because we can expect good things from this algorithm if, in fact, we can get it to work. But can we get it to work? What's the problem here? Is it smooth sailing? Are we done? Or do we have a problem that we have to deal with? Well, let's figure out what we want to do first before we figure out how much it's going to cost us. What is the difficulty with this? I mean, is this a trivial thing to do, or is there some problem here? Well, essentially, it's this problem, right? We're back to this problem again. Some of the children lead to goals and some don't, but we don't know which ones, right? So, yeah, we want this, but looking forward isn't really going to help us because we don't really know how to get to the goal state. So what does that mean we have to do? We have to rely on heuristics again. So we need, in order to do this, we're going to need a heuristic. But this time it's going to be slightly different from this one. Rather than looking backwards like this does, so the extended cost or extreme cost search derives its heuristic from looking backwards. This search that we're going to look at next gets its heuristic from looking forwards towards the goal. So yes, but we're going to need a forward-looking heuristic as opposed to the backward-looking heuristic that the extreme cost search had. So that's the first problem, is we have to come up with something, and I'll call it H for heuristic, that we can use to look forward. Right? And again, because it's a heuristic, it's a guess, which means it could be wrong. In fact, it will be wrong, but that's fine, as long as it gives us an edge towards the choice that we want to make. But before we do that, let's figure out how to use this if we have it. All right, so I have a start state here, and I'm winding around, and I end up at some intermediate state here. This is the cost. Again, this is the backwards part of this path, right? So that's the extreme cost part. This we can compute exactly because we know what the path is. What we're stuck at is this mystery path to the goal state because we don't know what that path is. That's the purpose of the H function. The H function will give us a value that we can use to assign some cost to this part of the path that we don't know about. The combination of those two things gives us the total cost, which I'll call T. T of N is then equal to C of N plus H of N. And then we can use this total cost value as our ordering for determining which child is best. All right, so that's the general idea, is to use T of N to pick good children, and we're going to do that by looking forward using this heuristic function. Does everyone understand this part? That's pretty, it's pretty straightforward. Now the question is, where does this heuristic function? Because the key here is coming up with this. we need to come up with a heuristic function, right? This is the point. If I can't come up with this, then this whole thing is useless. So, where does H come from? And the answer is it depends on the problem. Okay, there are some problems, like, for example, your programming assignment, your first programming assignment, that doesn't seem to have a heuristic function to it, so which means that I can't find one. Now, maybe it does have one. Maybe you'll figure it out. Maybe you're more clever than me, and you'll actually come up with a heuristic function that you can use. Right? But I haven't found one, and I don't know. I mean, maybe, and I've actually looked. I've searched on the web for heuristic functions for this problem, and apparently no one's found them. So this appears to be a problem-dependent function. Some problems don't have them, or at least appear not to have them, like your first homework assignment. Well, that's kind of unfortunate. Is there any kind of problem that has a heuristic function? Because if that's the case, if no problem has a heuristic function, then this is a waste of time. So what we need is an example of a problem that has a heuristic function. And we can find that by going back to the original problem that we used at the start of this section. What was the problem we talked about at the start of the section? It was the robot problem, right? We had a robot that had a rectangular gridded world, and it had a start state and a goal state and some obstacles. And the objective of the robot was to get from the start state to the goal state. What would you recommend, or what would you suggest as a heuristic function to use for this particular problem? What would seem like a sensible heuristic function? So the robot is on some square, and it needs to figure out which child to pick next, which is the better child to pick next. It can figure out the cost, and let's assume that the cost, does anybody remember what the cost of this problem was? It was the number of moves it needed to go from start to finish. So it knows how many moves it has made up to this point, and it needs to estimate or find a heuristic for the number of moves it needs to make to get to the goal state. So what would be a good heuristic for that? Well, one possibility is it could use the straight line distance, right? What's known as the Euclidean distance. It knows what the goal state is, it knows what its position is, and it just computes the Euclidean distance. Okay? That will give it a way to bias a particular choice of a child. So yeah, there are heuristic functions that you can use. Now, there are some important properties associated with this, and the most important one is that the heuristic function be an underestimate of the actual value of the cost of getting to the goal. And why is that the case? Why does it have to be an underestimate? Because if it was an overestimate, then you would tend to not take paths that have the overestimate. But remember, this is a guess. So if you're wrong, in fact, it could be cheaper along that path than you're estimating or have a heuristic for, but you're not going to take that path because it's too expensive. Right? So you want to make sure that you always are under the true cost of the path, okay, because then you won't miss the actual best path to use. So it has to be an underestimate and not an overestimate, and that's certainly the case for Euclidean distance in this problem. Does everyone understand this point? Because if you understand this point, then we're done. Because what do? You just take your extreme cost search and replace the function, where is it? Did I erase it? No, here it is. So you replace this part with this part. So you just essentially add the heuristic term to your extreme cost function, and that gives you T, and then you just go through and select the best value based on your criteria. All right? So you essentially use T. You use the T function, which includes the heuristic, in the extreme cost search. And when you do that, you get the search that's known as A star. You get the A star search. And if you can find a heuristic function for your problem, which as I indicated earlier, sometimes you can't, depending upon the nature of your problem, then the A-star search is probably one of the best searches that you can use, because it pretty much goes directly to the goal state. Now, there's some other criteria, right? First of all, we need to have a heuristic that's an underestimate. We need to have a heuristic for the problem. We need to have a heuristic that's an underestimate in all cases. Otherwise, we're going to miss the potential for optimal paths. And there's a third criteria that we need, which is we need to know the goal states. All right? Some problems will tell you the goal states, like, for example, the robot problem. Other problems will not. For example, your first programming assignment, you don't really know what the goal state is. You know what the characteristics of the goal states are, right? You only have one peg left on the board, but you don't know in which hole that peg is, right? So you don't really know the goal state. So the other reason that you can't really define a heuristic for your first programming assignment is because you don't know what the goal states are, the specific goal states. You can characterize the goal state, but you don't know in particular where the goal state is. That's one of the reasons I don't like that problem. There's lots of reasons why I didn't like it, but the fact that you can't use A-star search on it is one of them, because it would have been nice to be able to do that. I have an example of how A-star search works better than extreme search, but because we're running out of time, I will skip that. The final thing I'll say about A-star search is that under certain constraints on the problem on the search graph, A-star search will, first of all, find the optimal path for your definition of what it means to be optimal, and the first path it finds will be optimal. All right. So with respect to the particular problem that you're dealing with, right, so we've talked about two of the criteria. First of all, you need to have a heuristic function. Second of all, you need to know what the goal states are. And then there are two other technical issues. You need to have a lower positive bound on all weights. Okay, and also you need to have finite fan out on each of the nodes in the graph. Those are the technical. You can read about those in the text. But the two obvious ones are you need to have a heuristic function and you need to know what the goal states are. If you can satisfy those in your problem, then you can use A-star search to find an optimal path, and you can do it on the first win, the first goal state you find. And that's one of the reasons why people like A-star search. As a technical term, this is what's known as admissible. If you have a graph that satisfies those requirements, you have an admissible graph. Which means that if you run A-star search on that graph, you will get these results, assuming that the goal actually exists, which is one of the requirements. All right, so now we can answer these questions. What if A-star revisits a state that it has already expanded and discovered a shorter path? The answer to that question is? Exactly, it's not possible. Can't be done. Well, it could be done if you don't implement it correctly. So that's not a question you have to worry about with A-star. That is more or less going to end our discussion of informed searching, or heuristic-based searching, as the textbook calls it. Any questions? Alrighty, let us now go on and talk about the topic of tonight's lecture, which is essentially advanced searching techniques. So we're going to be looking at some advanced searching techniques. And these are not specific to any particular search. These are kind of like techniques that you can apply to any search, assuming it's appropriate at that point, to improve the nature of the search. The first technique that we're going to look at is going to help us deal with probably one of the more difficult characteristics of graphs, which several of you have hit on already. And what is that? Cycles, dealing with cycles. So what we would like to do is figure out when the search algorithm is caught in a cycle and then somehow avoid that cycle. And this goes to one of the questions that somebody asked. How is it possible to find out whether the graph has cycles in the case of depth-first search, and how backtracking helps for this? The answer is backtracking does not help for this. We need to do something else. But we will answer that question. That's the other reason I don't like the T-puzzle problem. No cycles. I really wanted you to get caught in cycles, but oh well. You lucked out this time. Alright, and the reason that cycles are bad is they cause infinite execution, for example, in the case of depth first search, or in the case of breadth first search, they could just infinitely expand the frontier. So, we would like to avoid cycles if we can, and the question is, how can we do that? And the answer is pretty obvious. How do we avoid cycles? And the answer depends on the nature of the search that you're using, so we'll start with depth first search, which has the easiest resolution to this problem. And once we understand how to do it for depth-first search, we'll move on to breadth-first search. So how would you deal with cycles in depth-first search? How would you recognize that depth-first search is in a cycle? What would be the characteristic? And, I mean, the easiest way to answer that question is to draw a little graph. Here's the start state. I think this is the graph we drew last Thursday. And so it was something like this, node 1, 2, 3, and then I guess the goal state was over here, like that. All right, so there's our cycle. We do a depth-first search. How does depth-first search know it's in a cycle? Is there any way, and this is the question that's being asked, right? How is it possible to find out whether the graph has cycles in the case of depth-first search? So what is there anything that could be used to determine whether or not depth-first search is pursuing a cycle? Right, because one thing that can happen is this is not the search state, so I'll take this child next. Goal state. This is not the goal state, so I'll take this child. This is not the goal state, so I'll take this child, and this child, and this child, and that, and that, and that. How do I avoid that? Easy, obvious. I'll give you a hint, we could use the Hansel and Gretel algorithm, if you know what that is. Otherwise, just look at the problem. How would you solve it? Well, the Hansel and Gretel, does anybody know the story of Hansel and Gretel? It's a long and difficult and complex story, but it starts off with two children walking in the forest, and they don't want to get lost. So they drop breadcrumbs as they walk. So they leave a trail when they can turn around and go back. They can follow. Okay? So how does that help here? Well, again, we would like to have depth-first search recognize when it's in a cycle. So what does it do? It drops breadcrumbs. It starts here and drops a breadcrumb and then goes here and a breadcrumb and here and a breadcrumb and here and a breadcrumb. And then it goes over here and says, oops, I've been there already because there's a breadcrumb. And so then it knows to pick the other path and it hits the goal. All right. So in the case of breadth-first search, we can put a bit in the state that is initially 0 or 1, depending upon which way you want to do it. And then as breadth-first search visits that state, it flips the bit. Okay, and as breadth-first search backtracks in case of failure, it returns the bit to its original state. Right. And that takes care of cycles, so we can have a visited bit for each of the states that gets set when depth-first search visits the state and then gets unset when it backtracks out of the state. All right, and that will keep depth-first search out of the cycles. Pretty straightforward. Now, what about breadth-first search? Will this technique work for breadth-first search? Does this, if we have a bit, a visited bit in each one of the states, will be able to detect when breadth-first search is in a cycle? And here, detecting cycles is not crucial, as it was for depth-first search, but it's just a way to save space, because like we argued earlier, essentially a cycle will cause the frontier to grow infinitely big, and that's not something we would like to have if we could avoid it. So we do want to actually detect cycles in breadth-first search too, and the question is, can we use the visited bit to do that? The answer is? No, you can't. Why not?
Because you cannot go back.
That's true, but it's not clear to me why is that crucial? I mean, that's sort of the right answer, but give me a little bit more, give me an answer you're right. Breadth first search cannot backtrack, but so what? Why is that important? or why is that crucial to not allowing or not having visit bits being satisfactory? Well, I already gave you the answer. What is in the frontier of breadth first search? All of the paths, not just one of them. Remember, depth first search has one path in the frontier, approximately. But breadth first search has all the paths, which means that you can't have a single bit because that path, that node, may be in many paths. And just because one node hasn't visited it doesn't mean that other nodes have. So it's not, you can't use a single bit to detect a cycle because just because a bit is already set doesn't mean it's been set on that particular path. So let's do a breadth first search here, right? We start at S and then we add 1 and 3. Okay, actually, let me, 1 and 3. Okay, and then we set that, and we go to, in this case, we go to 2, so now our path is S12, all right? Here we go S31. Now, 1's already been visited, but are we in a cycle yet? No. All right, so that's the problem. I have too many occurrences of the node, a particular state, in the frontier to get by with using one bit. So how can we detect cycles in breadth first search? Well, let's continue on to answer that question. So I've just demonstrated that visiting bits is unsatisfactory. Is there some other way that we can detect cycles? Well, let's go on. So let's take this path. So I have S and then 1 and then 2 and then 3, and now I'm going to hit 1. But how do I detect that I've already been at 1? How do I detect that this particular path has already been at 1? It's right in front of your eyes.
By observing the signal nodes.
Exactly. You search the path, and if you find the node, it's a cycle. Right? So unlike depth first search, which is essentially a constant time operation, right? Look at the bit, is it set or not? That's constant time, one instruction, for example. In breadth first search, you have to search backwards in the path, all the way back to the start node. If you see the node that you're proposing to visit, then it's already been visited, it's a cycle, don't go down that path, use another path. All right, so in this case, you have to search the path. And that is linear. It's order n, where n is the length of the path. You have to potentially, bless you, you have to potentially touch every node. So that's getting rid of cycles. Any questions about that? All right, so our next technique is, what is our next technique? And this one actually, so this is not relevant to your first programming assignment, because your first programming assignment doesn't have any cycles. But this next technique is, it is a consequence of a number of different properties associated with the graph. Let me see if I can draw a picture. All right, so here's my graph. I do a search, and let's see, does it matter? Well, let's do depth first search, although it doesn't really matter. I think that's true. So we go here. Let me give you these numbers. We go to 1, 2, 3, and then here's the goal state. So we start with S, and then we have S1, and then we have S12, and now what happens? This is depth first search. No children here, so this search fails, so you backtrack. No children here. This search fails, so you backtrack. We do have another child, so now we go to S3. And now we have a choice. What would be a wise choice here? Right, visiting, well, that's true. Let me make it a little bit less obvious. Now what would be a good choice? Why? Exactly. We've already been at 2. All right, the search has already visited 2, and it has demonstrated that visiting 2 is pointless. All right, in fact, we could even do this. We could put a cycle in here. All right, so now there's 3 choices. All right, but in 2 of those cases, we've already been to those nodes, and we're still searching, which means that these nodes must be failures. Otherwise, you would have found them over here. Right? So the point is, if you have a choice of going to a node that's already been visited, don't go to that node. Notice that this is not the same thing as a cycle. right? If we get rid of that green edge, we don't have any cycles here. But we're still visiting redundant nodes. Right? We're visiting nodes we've already been visited. And somebody asked a question about, the frontier. I said the frontier is, the back half of the frontier is visited, the front half is unvisited. Well, this is an example where that isn't quite correct. So the observation here is don't visit a fruitless node more than once. Let me not say node, let me say state. If the search observes that it's going to move to a node that's already been visited, don't do that. That's what's known as path pruning. All right. So you prune the path at that point and go off in some other direction. I mean, this is pretty obvious, right? It's not an incredibly complicated concept to deal with. But it is very effective. And this also helps to deal with the issue of putting a path into a state more than once. Notice that this does not help you with cycles, right? Because cycles just essentially increase the size of the frontier. The question is, will this work in all cases? Notice that I haven't specifically identified breadth first or depth first. The question is this some technique that's going to work in all cases? And to cut to the chase, the answer is no. This has a problem if you're dealing with extreme cost paths. So if you're doing an extreme cost search, you have to be careful with this technique. All right? And let's see if I can really quickly cook up an example why. All right, let's do a depth first search. And it looks like this. So here's the start state, here is one state, here is, let's say, the goal state, and here is another state, two, and here is. What we're interested in is the minimum cost, so I will give this a cost of 1, this a cost of 100, this a cost of 1, and this a cost of 1. Let's see, is that going to be sufficient? See, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, so we stumble onto this path, right, from S to 1 to G. We found the goal state, and it costs 101, right? But, of course, that's not the cheapest path because we can go S1 to G, and that only costs us 3. But the problem is we've already visited 1. Okay, so our objective here is to trim the path that we've already visited. Okay, so this approach would cause us to not go back to 1 to consider the other path. All right, so in this case, we're going to miss out on the shortest path if we find a longer path to the goal on the first try. Right, but remember what we're doing here is we're doing an extreme cost search, which means that we have to visit everything. And that's sort of the problem if you think about it, right? This is designed to trim off visiting states more than once, right? But if you're doing an extreme cost search, you in a sense have to find all paths, right? Because it could very well be you'll find a cheaper path like this than this, right? So in fact, you are required to visit nodes more than once in the case of an extreme cost search. If I'm just interested in a goal state, then that's fine. All right, so that's where that's the conflict is. So the question is, can we do path pruning with extreme cost search? Right. And it turns out the answer is yes. You have to do a little bit more complicated algorithms. And essentially, the way you work it is you essentially apply the extreme cost to each node in the path, right? So if you find a short path to 1, then you can reject all other longer paths to 1. Right, that's how you do the pruning. So in a sense, it's like the heuristic-based extreme cost, right? Except that you don't have to actually compute the heuristic, you just look at the actual values. And once you find a path, if you're on a longer path to 1, then you can reject that path because it's cheaper to go this way than to go a longer path. Okay, so that's the fundamental idea there. And there are two other rules. If the new path is in fact shorter, then you reject the old path and keep the new path, and then you have to splice in because you could end up in the middle of the path. And if it's shorter to get to the middle, through the old path, you keep that, and otherwise you keep the new path. So essentially, you have to extend path pruning here to splice in and out new paths. So it's a little bit more complicated, but the same technique still applies. Any questions about that? About path pruning? This is a really useful technique when you can find circumstances for it. And let me think. I do believe there is a useful... This is a useful technique to use in your first programming assignment. Because your first programming assignment is, in fact, if you draw out the state space graph for small examples of the problem, you'll find that it's a DAG. Right, so you can be visiting things more than once, and you either know whether or not that leads to a solution or not, and you've already been there, because if you're still searching, that's a failure, so you don't even need to pursue that further. So this is actually a technique that's useful. Also, because you're not doing an extreme cost search in your first assignment, so this is actually something you can apply. All right, let's go on to the next technique. Give me the pluses and minuses of breadth first search. What's the advantage of breadth first search? Shortest path, which I'll abbreviate SP, and the disadvantage? We have exponential growth. Depth first search? Cycles, true, but with respect to what we talked about with respect to breadth first search, you're right about cycles. But we know how to take care of those. So that's not a problem anymore depth first search. But with respect to what we talked about in depth first search, you may not get the shortest path. So not shortest path. Possibly, if you are so unlucky as to run into some other goal that is longer than the shortest, closest goal, then you're going to lose. But it's linear in space. So in a sense, we have opposing virtues. Breadth first search will find shortest paths, where depth first search may not. Let's just assume it won't. And breadth first search is exponential in space, whereas depth first search is linear. So when you have something like that, when you have two techniques which are essentially opposites of one another, it is a standard idea to combine them in hopes that you get the best of both. So we would like to combine breadth-first search plus depth-first search to get a search that has the properties that it gives me the shortest path, and it takes linear space. That's what we'd like to do. And the question is, how do we do that? How do we do that combination? The answer is we do iterative deepening. Because we want this requirement, we have to pick one of these two things. And the question is, how should we base our combined algorithm? Which of these two should we base our combined algorithm on? And the answer is, you probably want to use depth-first search, right? Because depth-first search will give you... breadth-first search requires exponential space. It's very difficult to get rid of exponential space. All right, so from that point of view, we have to go to breadth-first search to get the linear behavior. But we have this problem of shortest path. So how do we deal with the shortest path problem? This is the tricky part.
Least cost method.
That is sort of correct. But the question is, what is the cost? Notice I haven't identified this as a value problem, a cost problem. So you may not have cost, but you are right. There is a cost that we're interested in here. And what is that cost? It's the path length, right? The shortest path. So how can we make sure that depth-first search actually finds the shortest path? Let me ask the question this way. Why wouldn't breadth-first search find the shortest path? Let's look at this example. What would prevent this is actually a bad example because we only have one goal and there's only one path to it. All right, let's take this example. What would prevent depth first search, from finding the shortest path? Well, again, it's a cycle, right? So the question is, how can we drive depth first search to find the shortest path, which is this way? Okay, I've given you enough time. What's the answer? Well, again, let's look at this this particular version of the problem. How can we force depth-first search to find the shortest path? What is the shortest path here? 2. So how can we force depth-first search to find the shortest path then? Yes, but how do we do that? How do we know? In this case, you know. All right. So how do you force depth-first search to find the minimal length? Because it could go this way. It could go into a big cycle for quite a while and then spin out at 3 and hit the goal.
Based on the visited nodes.
Sorry? Based on the visited nodes.
Avoiding repetition.
That avoids the cycles, but it doesn't... Well, all right, I could draw the picture this way, too. All right, let's do it this way, then. All right, now the cycles are gone, and now visited nodes won't help you. The shortest path is still 2, but how do I keep depth-first search from finding this path? The answer is I restrict the depth to which depth-first search can go. Okay, so I have a limited depth-first search, which I'll call LDFS. Right? In addition to passing in the state space graph and the start nodes, I put a limit on the depth to which depth-first search can go. And clearly, if I put the limit of 2 here, even if depth-first search makes the wrong choice and goes here, it's going to stop here. And then when it stops here, it's going to backtrack and then go down and find this goal state, which is going to be 2. Okay, so does every... I'll come to that in a second. But does everyone understand the point here? By limiting the search, the depth of the search that depth-first search can make, I can then find the goal state. So in a certain sense, it is like the way breadth-first search. How does breadth-first search find the shortest path to the goal state? It essentially searches everything at length 1, right? And then it searches everything at length 2. And then it searches all the states at length 3 from the start state. Right? So that's the ring effect. What we want to do is we want to have depth-first search have that same ring effect. And we do that by limiting the depth to which it can search. So we start by saying, okay, you can only make one jump. Right? You can only search to depth 1. And that essentially will check every child that is 1 away from the start node. If that succeeds, then great. You have found the closest goal or one of the closest goals to the start state. If it fails, what do? Well, now you look at 2. All right, so now you look for 2. And then you'll find the goal there. Congratulations, that is now the closest. So that's the idea. And that's what iterative deepening is. You essentially have a sequence of limited depth first search where the limit increases at every failure to find a goal state. All right, and that's what's known as iterative deepening. That's essentially it. And this is a really common technique. You find this technique all over the place. When I taught networking last semester, we talked about peer-to-peer networks. And this is a technique that you can use to route packets in peer-to-peer networks. Because the problem with peer-to-peer networks is you don't know what the graph looks like. Right? Because they're peer-to-peer. They can essentially arrive in the network and depart from the network at arbitrary times and in arbitrary locations. So you have no idea what the graph looks like, and so you have no idea how to do routing. One of the ways you can do routing is related to iterative deepening. So this is a fairly common technique which appears in a lot of different places, not just intelligent system search. All right, is there anything else I would like to say about iterative deepening? You could apply this to also A-star search, because A-star search is essentially depth-first search. I have an example code here, but then so does the textbook, so I won't write that down since we're running out of time. Now, there is one problem here, which is what? If you think about what we were talking about with respect to this graph, you're repeatedly revisiting nodes, right? I mean, you search all the children at... And this is one of the ways in which it is different from breadth-first search. You search all the children that are 1 away from the start state, And then what do you do again? You start another search of depth 2, which immediately searches all the children of depth 1 away from the start state again. Okay? And if the search at depth 2 fails, then you start one at 3, and then that reevaluates all the children at 1 and all the children at 2. Right? So you're constantly reevaluating the states that are not successful, that are not goal states. Okay. Now that could be a problem. It depends on how expensive it is to evaluate a search. Okay, once you create the graph, however, you can just traverse it relatively cheaply. And the book has a little mathematical calculation that shows that, in fact, the reevaluation is really not that bad, which I will leave it to you to discover. Oh, that's it. We don't have any time. Let me just mention, again, they're in the text. There's a couple more in the text, but the important one that we don't have time to get to tonight is called branch and bound. You can think of this as a combination of pruning along with extreme cost search. Okay, because remember, pruning says that if you've already visited a node, then it's a failed node. You don't have to visit it again. You can just prune that entire path. Well, if you have a value search and a cost search, an extreme cost search, if you are on a path, if you have found one path to the goal, and you're on another path that is more expensive, then you don't need to consider that path any further because it's not going to get cheaper under certain constraints, which the book will talk about, which are fairly obvious, though. So you can essentially do pruning based on the cost of the path in the same way that the extended cost search does. Well, actually, the extended cost search doesn't do pruning. It just biases the choice of the next child. All right, so branch and bound is essentially extreme cost search with pruning based on the cost of the path so far. And that is it. Are there any questions?